Contrary to rumor, Jeremy Burdick didn't beat me up. I didn't move to Arizona to join the priesthood. I didn't drown trying to save one of my campers at Camp Davis. I was not institutionalized because of schizophrenia. I just went away to boarding school. I didn't tell anyone because I hadn't planned on going. Ninth grade hadn't been a hardship. I'd made a number of popular friends and discovered that I was really good at American Sign Language and working with kids. I had every intention of returning to Cranberry Lake High and yawning my way through another year's worth of classes. My grandfather had other ideas. I'd learned long ago that my grandfather's ideas were always more important than my own. My first real memory of him was when I was 3 or 4. I was watching the Smurfs or the Snorks or some tirelessly friendly cartoon inspired by a Belgian comic book. My grandfather walked in the room, changed the TV to the news, and then walked out of the room. I turned the cartoon back on. He walked into the room, changed it to the news, and walked out. I changed it back to the cartoons. When he came back in, I asked, "You want to watch the news?" "No," he said. "I read the paper this morning. I want you to watch the news." And he turned the channel back to the news and pulled the dial off the TV. During the summer between 9 and 10th grades, I was a summer camp counselor in training. I helped run the sports program and I taught swimming lessons, and nobody drowned during them. I had planned on being there all 10 weeks, but during the 5th week, my grandfather stopped by. He was captaining a boat from Jacksonville, Florida to Portland, Maine. I'd gone with him for the southern part of the journey when I was 12. This summer, he wanted me to help him out with the Cranberry Lake to Portland leg. I agreed, because I had no choice. I figured it was a 3-day trip, max, and I was technically correct. We arrived in Portland the next day, spent one day at my uncle's house eating lobster and catching up with relatives, and the next day he rented a car and we began driving, I assumed, home. I assumed wrong. "Reunion weekend at my old high school," he said, and I knew I was doomed to spend the next 2 days with his fellow septuagenarians listening to dull stories about their childhood and how I looked just like my grandfather, which was a lie, as I was adopted and shared none of his body or facial design. I also knew I'd have to take some sort of tour where a smiling admissions officer would tell me how much fun I'd have there with a great drama department they had, how I could volunteer to work with kids, and how I would yada yada smile, love it there. I knew that if my grandfather wanted me to go there, odds were good. I was going to go there no matter what I wanted. Plus, it meant I wouldn't have to watch my parents fumble toward their inevitable divorce. So, when I got home, I told my parents how much I loved the school and sure I'd really apply myself there, and could I please go back to my summer at Camp Davis now? 3 days after camp ended, my parents drove me back to Torpor Heights, carried a bunch of my clothes and belongings up the 4 flights of stairs to my room, and took me out to lunch. My mother cried, my father was proud of me, back in Florida my grandfather was proud of me. The only thing I was excited about was meeting my new roommate. Through a fluke in the admissions process, I'd been booked into the biggest room in the dorm, a triple, but there'd only be 2 of us. Whereas all the other room had a single cumbersome wardrobe, our room had 2 walk-in closets and 2 cumbersome wardrobes. We also had a bunk bed and a non-bunk bed. My roommate, though absent when I had moved in, had already been in the room and claimed a closet and the non-bunk bed, which was totally fine with me. It was a few minutes after my parents left when one of the student leaders knocked on my door.
"Hey, my name's Manuel. I'll be living across the hall. You met your roommate yet?"
"Not yet."
"Oh, man."
He made "oh, man" sound precisely like, "I'm so sorry that your puppy got murdered. But don't worry, you're going to get a chance to see him real soon, because you're about to get hit by a very big truck with very spiky tires."
"Oh, man?" I asked.
My very first roommate at Torpor Heights was a 21-year-old sophomore named Yao Wen Handsome, a Chinese student whose mother had recently married a very inaccurately named banker named Derek Handsome. Their marriage was some sort of business arrangement that for some reason meant that Yao Wen had to change his last name to his American stepfather's. Yao Wen had been in America for 2 weeks when school started, and the only English he spoke was "yes, no, and I want to fuck your eyes," which had been taught to him by one of the very unscrupulous hockey jocks who lived down the hall from us. I hoped that his English would improve quickly, as Torpor Heights Academy had one of the premier English as a second language programs. Alas, instead of teaching him things he could use, like How do I get to the science building? Do you mind if I use your stereo to blast my shitty Chinese pop music while you're trying to sleep? Or, excuse me, I had some really spicy food for dinner. They taught him annoying phrases like, need your help now, and giant breastises. A phrase he liked to use about as often as he liked to announce that he wanted to fuck my rice. No matter how many times I explained that I didn't like my rice fucked, he insisted that he would be really good at it. After the third night in a row that he'd slapped me awake at 3 a.m. to ask me for help with his homework, I started setting up a line of tennis balls in the little dip between my bunk and the wall, and every time I caught him walking in my direction, I'd chuck one at his head. I wasn't the only person in the school who was less than pleased with the existence of Yao Wen Handsome. Next door to Manuel's room were 2 juniors, a shaved-headed punk fan named Jack Marple and a purple-headed goth rocker who voluntarily went by the name of Roadkill. I wasn't present when Roadkill and Yao Wen began their war. I don't know who first insulted who, but I do know that I came home from dinner during the third week of school to find Roadkill running down the hall. Yao Wen was chasing him with 3 of my tennis balls in his hands, chucking them at Roadkill, yelling, "No shoes on bed! No shoes on bed!" After the 4th time the dorm head was called to settle a dispute between Yao Wen and one of our floormates, I made a request that he be moved out of my room. I was assured that I'd have permission to request a change of roommates by the end of the week. 3 weeks and 12 or so excuses later, I decided to take matters in my own hands. One of the other sophomores who lived on the 3rd floor had the unfortunate pleasure of sharing a room with a kleptomaniac named Charlie Denton. Barely a month into the school year, and Charlie had been caught stealing 2 jackets, 12 or so CDs, and Roadkill's favorite hairbrush. Bullshit! J-Bob, Denton's unfortunate roommate, said. Stolen 2 of my Guns N' Roses bootlegs, sharpied out my name, and wrote his own. My favorite jacket disappeared my first day here. I asked the dorm head to transfer rooms. He told me get it done by the end of the week. It was 2 weeks ago. Fuck, dude. It's an empty room on your floor. I don't get why one of us can't move into it. I have a better idea, I said. That afternoon, while Yao Wen was in class, J-Bob and I moved all of his furniture and clothes into the empty room, and moved all of J-Bob's furniture into my room. This way, I said, we can claim that you didn't know I didn't have permission to move Yao Wen's shit out, and with any luck, the dorm head will feel sorry for you and let things stay the way we want them. Which is pretty much what happened. Yao Wen came back from class, flipped out that all his stuff had been moved, and found the nearest Chinese interpreter to take his case to the dorm head, who initially flipped out, then shook his head after Yao Wen left and said, "Well played. You guys can be roommates, but don't pull any shit like that again, or I'll put you on disciplinary probation." Little did he know, J-Bob and I had one more game to play before we felt we were even. See, every Wednesday morning, there was a mandatory all-campus meeting at our chapel. The student leaders checked each of us in at the beginning of the meeting, and we'd sit in our assigned pews, listening to the deans or the headmaster or a guest speaker fill our minds with morality or mortality or whatever opinion they were determined to inflict on us. J-Bob and I had loyally attended each one, but we knew that Denton liked to sneak out and take a cab into town and shoplift, since he had the 2 post-meeting periods open. On this particular morning, I checked in with Manuel, and J-Bob checked in with his student leader. Then we excused ourselves to go to the bathroom. While our dorm mates listened to our headmaster explain how important cultural diversity was to a school like ours, J-Bob and I broke into their rooms and began playing a game of kleptomaniac scavenger hunt bingo. I took Roadkill's brush and Jack's New York Doll CD. J-Bob took David's drumsticks and Victor's Argentinian porno magazine. I took our resident Republican's U2 poster and his roommate's favorite sweatshirt. And together, we went up and down all floors, taking 1 or 2 things from each room, including our own, and scattering them all throughout Denton's room. Then, we went to our 4th period classes. Neither of us were there to witness the beginning of the chaos. Seeing as he'd already caught Denton stealing his hairbrush once, Roadkill knew where to go when he discovered it missing a second time, and of course, he saw Jonathan Fletcher torque the 4th U2 poster, and he told him about it. JFT4 saw David's drumsticks and one of the other student leaders' guitar, and on and on and on and on. When Denton came back, he was pulled into the dorm head's apartment. He was completely befuddled and swore he was innocent, but he was wearing J-Bob's favorite jacket and had the inside pockets stuffed with CDs that were stolen from the local music store. He was kicked out at the end of the week. For the remainder of the first trimester, J-Bob and I got along famously. Despite his justifiable concern over my taste in music, I had possibly just gone out of a pop phase and had a Mariah Carey CD and some Paula Abdul tapes scattered throughout my U2 and Nirvana, we found we had a lot in common. Our honeymoon period was brief, but enjoyable. Both of us had work jobs, the most redundantly named program at the school, and those work jobs were in the dining hall. He served lunch, I helped prepare dinner. One night, while squeezing whipped cream onto the lime jello, one of the salad ladies approached me with a petition.
"You know that Yowen kid?"
she asked. I told her that we'd been roommates.
"Well, the faculty and students that have work here have been having problems with the way he talks to people and the way he touches them."
I relayed the story about my walk back to the dorm after my first tennis class when Yowen had touched my ass, how I'd firmly shook my head and said, "Don't touch me," and how he'd touched me again anyways, and how I'd cracked him over the head with my tennis racket and ran like hell to the dining hall.
"So you'll sign this.
What will it do?" That week, it got him banned from the back of the line in the dining hall. He could still eat there, but he wasn't allowed to even talk to the cooks or the students serving the food. The next week, he was told he was no longer welcome at the farm. It wasn't too long before I came back from French class to find his new room empty. Some months later, my guidance counselor told me he'd been sent to an institution better suited to his needs.
No things to make my brain seem scarred. Sleep, my friend, and you will see the dream is my reality. They keep me locked up in this cage. Can't they see it's why my brain says rage? Sanitarium. Leave me be.
Bob and I had always joked about how our dorm room was really a sanitarium. We even blasted the Metallica song of the same name every night after study hall. Aside from our former roommates and the poster child for safe sex that was Roadkill, there was no shortage of weirdos in our dorm. Right around the time that Denton was getting kicked out of the school, someone began shitting in the showers. It started on the third floor, prompting an all-floor meeting about sanitary conditions. A week later, there was an incident on the first floor, then the second, and eventually even our own floor was hit. After 4 weeks of terror at the ass of the phantom shitter, a few of the hockey jocks set up a sting operation, and a kid named Jaleel Johnson was caught dropping a deuce during a late-night shower session. He was put on disciplinary probation for a semester, and the shitting ceased. Shortly after his probationary status was up, the third floor was besieged by an even more terrible odor than was usual for a floor full of adolescent jocks. When a floor parent discovered that someone had shit in the communal trash can, an all-dorm meeting was held. Didn't take long before the finger was pointed at Jaleel.
"I mean, come on," Manuel said. "The guy shits for fun. As soon as he's no longer in danger of getting kicked out of the school, he starts shitting again."
"I swear, guys," Jaleel said. "Wasn't me. I mean, shitting in the shower is funny, but shitting in the garbage can is just gross."
The second phantom shitter was never publicly outed, but during his free second period, screams could be heard from Jaleel's bedroom. After a few minutes, a couple of the hockey jocks came out of his room laughing. Jaleel showed up at the dining hall that afternoon in a hat. His prodigious afro had been shaved off. From then on, all shit was directed into toilet bowls. The hockey jock alpha male was a hick named Francis White. He was 6 feet tall and 240 pounds of mostly muscle. In addition to putting the hit out on Jaleel's hair, he was commonly believed to be the mastermind behind the Charlie Denton kleptomania outing. And he was rumored to be the master of ceremonies for a weekly gathering of hockey players that involved a game called Dirty Nachos. "Dirty Nachos?" I asked J-Bob when he first told me about the meetings.
Dirty nachos, he said. Basically, a bunch of teammates get together in France's room the night after the game. They all whip out their cocks and start jerking off into a pile of nachos. Whoever finishes last has to eat them.
That is the most disgusting thing I've ever heard,
J-Bob laughed. Now you know why I don't play hockey.
Thought you didn't play hockey because you were too short.
J-Bob was, in fact, 5'2". Some of the hockey jocks joked that J-Bob hadn't hit puberty yet, but as his roommate, I can attest that if he hadn't yet reached adolescence, then he was the hairiest prepubescent boy in the history of the human race. He had hands like mittens and otter legs. Jonathan Fletcher Torque IV started referring to J-Bob as Alf after the popular alien TV star of our childhood.
Ha!
One weekend, my parents drove me home for a doctor's appointment and to announce the dissolution of their marriage. While I was there, I picked up the stuffed Alf doll that my grandmother had given me when I was in the fourth grade. While J-Bob was away at class, I put one of the hats on Alf and left it on his bed. When I got back from my own class, I found the Alf doll, still with J-Bob's hat on, hanging by the neck from a water pipe with a handwritten note taped to his chest that said, "You're next." To make up for the prank, I bought him dinner from the best sub place that delivered to campus. Turkey and bacon, J-Bob said as he devoured his sub. All is forgiven. The next weekend, J-Bob's girlfriend visited from New York. I gave them as much space as I could, spending most of my day either at the library or down in the basement watching cartoons. When she left, she gave J-Bob a quick peck on the cheek and said,
"Later, Juicy."
"Juicy?" I asked.
"Yeah? What do you think J-Bob stands for?"
I had no idea. I thought it was just his name.
"Juicy Buckets of Bacon."
My spleen burst. "His real name is James." "I swear to God," J-Bob said, "if you tell anyone, I will kill you in your sleep." I didn't tell very many people, but when I was feeling frisky, I'd often poke him in the stomach and say, "Juicy." He didn't kill me very much. They think our heads are in their hands, but violent use brings violent plans. The two of us survived the year, both as friends and roommates. J-Bob and I decided to try our luck with the incoming juniors the next year. Both our roommates ended up being slightly annoying, but not nearly as bad as Yao Wen or Denton. Still, my roommate got homesick halfway through the fall trimester and moved back to Germany, and J-Bob's roommate moved to the other campus to be closer to the stoners he hung out with. We briefly entertained the idea of rooming together our senior year, but ended up tempting the fates of the admissions office. J-Bob roomed with a Korean student who spent most of his non-class time swimming and making lame jokes. My roommate was a Saudi Arabian with a serious addiction to masturbation. I'd walk in on him at least 4 times, and several of our floor mates had caught him too, so I asked if he minded moving down the hall to one of the singles. He didn't mind. This gave me all the time in the world to indulge my own masturbation addiction without the fear of getting caught. I knew when to lock the door. I was in the midst of one of these sessions when the sophomore across the hall came knocking on my door. I think J-Bob was the one who nicknamed him my across-the-hall neighbor Fledge. "He's like a you in training, a little fledgling Adam," he'd said. "He has the same obnoxious laugh, he makes the same weird noises, and he tells the same stupid jokes you used to tell when we were roommates." He was right on every count. In addition to his warped sense of humor, Fledge was a sci-fi fan and an aspiring writer.
Once a week or so, he'd stop by my room or invite me into his to talk about ideas he was working on or to tell me his latest terrible joke. The night he nearly interrupted my masturbation session, I pretended not to be in the room. He made some buzzing sounds and a few beeps to indicate his displeasure at me not answering the door, but I was determined to finish what I'd started. The problem was that I had started the fantasy thinking of some nondescript, well-rounded ass. There was no one in particular attached to it. It was just the floating ass of pleasure, designed to please only me. If I'd stopped to examine it, I'd probably notice that it bore a striking resemblance to Kevin Harris's ass, or perhaps Saint's. But I didn't stop, and I didn't notice. But when Fledge started making those noises, the floating ass of pleasure started to expand. Soon, it was attached to a smooth back with defined shoulder blades. Then, there were shoulders. And soon, there was even a head at the end of the torso, Fledge's head. And he was making those noises, and he was doing that thing he did with his face when he was pretending to be deliriously happy, and then... And then I toweled off. knocked on his door. "You rang?" I asked. "Knocked, actually. Were you asleep?" I shrugged my shoulders. "Kind of. What's up?" He was. I missed the first few sentences of his conversation because his enormous penis was hanging out of the hole in his boxers. "Fledge?" I said. "You're hanging out." He looked down where I was looking, tucked it back in. "Sorry," he said. "Has a mind of its own." And then he began talking about a band called Floating Ass of Pleasure, Defined Shoulder Blades, That Deliriously Happy Face. "You know?" I told him I did know, though I hadn't paid a single bit of attention to what he said. I knew that while I had successfully beaten it once already that night, my penis was itching for a rematch. "And I'm pretty sure I could suck my own dick," Fledge said. "What?" "I mean, I'm still pretty flexible from when I took gymnastics, and..." "Well..." He patted his package. "You know." I'd like to think that at any other point in my life, I'd have been smart enough to realize that this incredibly hot, well-hung, beautiful guy was hitting on me. And not with a fist. He was hitting on me with a sledgehammer. Unfortunately, having the self-esteem of a chalk stick figure in the Louvre, I thought he was idly bragging and passed up an opportunity to take the virginity of the first acknowledged guy of my dreams. I was no longer a virgin myself. Well, I was still a virgin in the Christian or the Clinton sense, as none of the two pleasure centers below my waist had ever been in any way entangled with a pleasure center below anyone else's waist. I had, however, exchanged blowjobs with a hot Korean guy on the final night of my junior year before he'd graduated, and I'd headed back to Cranberry Lake for the summer. When we were done, he'd gone through the school yearbook and pointed out all of the guys he found attractive.
"What kind of guys do you like?"
he'd asked, and with a totally straight face, I told him I wasn't gay. I don't think ignorance is truly bliss, but denial is certainly amusing. For the rest of the year, Fledge made easily dozens of suggestive and flirtatious commentary that I dismissed because I was too fat to be attractive, and besides, I wasn't gay. I just jerked off to thoughts of guys. I dated women. No. Really. I'd used Jennifer as my fake girlfriend during my sophomore year. At the beginning of my junior year, one of the heavy-set, curly-haired girls who'd always wore just a bit too much makeup and sang alto in the choir had developed quite a crush on me. I'd remained my usually oblivious self until she rammed her tongue into my tonsils in the hallway outside the auditorium. Kate and I had what I referred to as a platonic romance. I bought her a stuffed white bear shortly before Christmas break, and occasionally let her kiss me. I didn't kiss her back, but I told myself that it wasn't because I was gay. I wasn't interested in her because she was fat. Just after Christmas break, I was in a school production of Romeo and Juliet. Originally, I'd had the role of Paris, as our director had the idea of casting all black students as Montagues and all white students as Capulets. When the Black Romeo dropped out, the entire show was recast in the new version. I was to play both Benvolio and Balthazar, with J-Bob playing Mercutio. The roles suited us, and we spent most of our backstage time sword fighting and making jokes. It was during some of my non-J-Bob backstage time that I first got to know our stage manager, Becky. Becky liked to play with my sword, the prop. She would rub it and purr every chance she got. "Think she likes you," J-Bob said. "No shit." Even I was not that oblivious. Of course, the problem was that I was still not dating Kate. "Yeah, but," J-Bob said, "Kate is, well, you know, Becky is not Kate." But Becky was dating a computer geek named Harold, the un-hairiest Harold in the known universe. One day, in mid-January, un-Harry, Becky and I had lunch together in one of the dining halls on the other campus. While un-Harry looked on, Becky kept trying to unbuckle my belt, unbutton my jeans, or unzip my fly. Un-Harry wasn't the only person watching this little display. My choir teacher, my pre-calculus teacher, four kids from my psychology class, and the kitchen workers had a front row seat. As did Kate, who stormed out of the dining room. She was waiting for me by my dorm room later that night. "You can have your stupid bear back," she said, shoving it in my hands. And I probably could have explained that I wasn't really interested in Becky, that she'd been flirting with me, not the other way around, but this was the perfect way to decatify. How macho I was, being dumped by the fat girl because the hot purple-haired girl with the big breasts couldn't keep her hands off me. How macho. How straight.
Who do you think you're fooling with these things you're doing? You're gonna start a scandal. Burn that midnight candle.
You are listening to the fourth episode of the In Safe Mode Journals. Welcome home, parenthetical phrase, sanitarium. This episode was brought to you by www.crookedtreehouse.com, Napster, The Pirate Bay, and other things that make Lars Ulrich sad. The music for this episode was mainly Metallica's Welcome Home. Sanitarium is a parenthetical phrase. Must be a theme. But the outro is Who Do You Think You're Fooling by Captain Beefheart. Now, if you'll excuse me, there's someone knocking at the door. They have a very comfortable-looking white coat. They're asking me to go with them. I can't say no.